From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the pages of Scientific American with a question. Was the extreme 2017 hurricane season driven by climate change? And the answer, according to the various experts in Scientific American, is yes. Just quoting from a couple of sections, they write, since 1981, the maximum wind speed of the most powerful hurricanes has risen, according to climatologist research. Also, experts expect that climate change may increase the intensity of hurricane rainfall. The unprecedented deep flooding in the Houston area certainly bears witness to that. And then, of course, we can look to so many other places of devastation, Puerto Rico and beyond. And maybe this feels too big for you. Maybe this feels like an issue that day to day you can think about climate change, but it feels beyond our grasp to do anything about it. But that is not exactly the case. In fact, the New York Climate Solutions Summit is coming up on Saturday, aiming to build a larger movement across our region that can take action. And if you're wondering about day to day, what you can think about, what you can do, what is within reach, that is part of the discussion. I want to bring in some guests as we preview what's coming up on Saturday, and we will talk about these issues and more and take some of your phone calls. In studio with me here in Rochester is Abby McHugh Griffin. She's the leadership team co-coordinator of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Abby, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having us, Evan.
Neely Kelly is New York State senior organizer for Mothers Out Front. Neely, welcome back to the program to you.
Thank you, Evan.
On the line with us is Sandra Steingraber. She is a distinguished scholar in residence in the Department of Environmental Studies at Ithaca College, and she will be there on Saturday. Sandra, welcome back to the program. Thank you for taking the time.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Can I start with you, Sandra, on that question of bigness? I mean, this has been a devastating set of weeks and months here in terms of just the places in the hurricane zone. And yes, I mean, I think I don't want to take a look at every single weather day. I don't want to look at the fact that it was 103 degrees at the first pitch of the World Series in LA and say climate change every single time. But what Scientific American is telling us is that, yes, there is an impact, that storms get more intense. And yes, we are seeing that on an almost daily basis. Sandra, for people who feel like it's getting, you know, sort of beyond our grasp on a day-to-day as citizens, what do you say to them?
Well, the science is is clear and becomes clear all the time. And so, yes, we have a monumental problem. I think that if there's any hopeful note in this whole story, it's that we have not yet entered a period of time whereby even the most rapid decarbonization and embrace of renewables is a futile exercise. In other words, we have a small window of time where we can make really big changes. And therefore, because all of life depends on us doing that, we have a moral obligation to do that. And the other piece of good news is, I think, that what's killing the planet, namely heat-trapping gases, is also killing us in the form of air pollution, because when you light fossil fuels on fire, you don't just destabilize the climate. You also kill people through ground-level ozone and VOCs. You give children asthma. You contribute to stroke and heart attack. And we could actually save 4,000 New Yorkers' lives every year by switching over to renewables. We can employ them in the renewable energy industry. So it's even though the task is monumental, the risks are, the rewards are also monumental.
All right, so this Saturday is the New York Climate Solutions Summit. You can jump online to find more, and I think they still have a few slots if you'd like to attend. It's 8 to 5, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Harley School, and it's nyclimatesummit.org, nyclimatesummit.org. Abby, what's the larger goal here?
Well, the focus on solutions, really. You know, as a movement, we have been talking about the problem for so long. And actually, I think at this point, you know, there's pretty widespread recognition that climate change is a problem and that we do need to do something about it, but not nearly as much awareness on the side of what can we do and how do we do it. So we're at the point where we need to be focusing on that and talking about that and educating ourselves, really, about the nitty-gritty details of what this means.
Okay. Neely, your thoughts on what can come out of Saturday?
Yeah, I think one of the, well, before I should get started, I really want to give a shout out to the team that has planned this really incredible summit. We have an amazing lineup of keynote speakers, workshops, information sessions to not only understand what solutions are out there at a policy level, but also how individuals can engage. And so I'm just really excited about the day and wanted to add there are more than a few slots left open,
okay.
You know, where registration is open through the end of the week. So we have space for just about anybody that wants to join.
NYClimateSummit.org right now if you want to register. I know Neely and Abby wanted to grab onto one specific part of the discussion about Saturday, which has come up in advance. There were questions about food being served, because food is actually part of the climate conversation, and I know there's something you wanted to add on that. Abby, Neely, you want to take that now?
Right. So we put quite a bit of thought into what the menu would be at the summit. And when I say quite a bit of thought, I mean, this is actually the question we spent the most time on in the organizing, because we understand that food choices are very personal and people have very strong feelings, preferences, dietary restrictions. You know, there's all sorts of issues that come into just deciding what to serve to eat. And yes, you know, greenhouse gases from animal agriculture is a really serious issue. And so, you know, the climate movement, broadly speaking, is moving in a direction of encouraging a plant-based diet. And, you know, that's good for your health, too. There's all sorts of, you know, it's win-win there. But ultimately, we decided that at the summit, we would serve a small amount of meat, that we would have meat available for those who, that's what they eat. You know, and the reasoning behind that was we want to create a climate movement that is welcoming to all people. All people, meaning vegans, vegetarians, meat eaters in all shapes, size, and colors. There's a place in the climate movement for everyone to get involved. And since food can be such a flashpoint, we didn't want to set it up as a you only belong here if you adhere to a strictly plant-based diet, or on the opposite side, you must eat meat. It's not about even policing people's individual choices. It's about creating awareness around this issue. Giving people opportunities to get involved. And ultimately, we need to reduce the average of how much meat we are eating as a society. Americans eat a lot of meat. It's, you know, pretty safe to say that we eat too much meat from an environmental perspective. And so we need to reduce that overall. But does that mean that someone who does continue to eat meat can't still make a very meaningful contribution to the climate movement? It does not mean that. And we want everyone at this summit, regardless of what they choose to eat.
Is there a danger if there's a purity test here? Will you drive some people out of the movement with that?
Well, so this is the question. You know, I think we have historically maybe been a little too ideologically rigid with who is allowed to participate and what they have to look like, be like, do in order to take part. So by choosing to include meat, that ideological purity test is exactly what we are trying to do away with. And so, you know, if we can reduce, you know, our consumption of meat products, animal agriculture, by 90%, that would be great. But similarly, we need to implement other solutions at a similar degree. So we all need to be turning off our lights at least 90% of the time. We all need to be insulating our house at least 90% more. We need to, you know, so it kind of, the list goes on and on and on about no one has to be perfect. We are human. We understand that. We all have our eco vices. I know in my case, I take showers that are too long. That's my big one. You know, I should use less hot water without a doubt. But I still feel that I can contribute meaningfully to this movement without being perfect, and so can everyone else.
All right, so it's nyclimatesummit.org. If you want to register, tickets are $20. Let me go through some of the specifics that they're planning on for Saturday, and then I'm going to ask Sandra Steingraber to talk about what she is going to be bringing in terms of her closing keynote. So their morning keynote is from a man who's been the Sierra Club president, who's been on this program, Aaron Mayer, opening panel on renewable energy, land use, transportation, and energy efficiency. They'll have case study presentations on wind, solar, energy efficiency, transportation, land use, and environmental justice. The remarkable Orrin Lyons will be there from the Onondaga Nation with a lunchtime keynote, technical workshops on understanding how electricity works, tapping into NYSERDA's resources, how to meaningfully participate in the New York Public Service Commission, energy democracy in New York State, navigating the power plant siting process. Then there will be a number of other workshops leading up to the closing keynote with Sandra Steingraber. And Sandra, what are you going to be talking about?
Well, I'm going to call everyone to heroic action. I mentioned that 4,000 New Yorkers a year have their lives shortened by exposure to air pollution. Those numbers, if you look overall, 9 million people around the world die every year by exposure to pollution. Most of that is caused because we exhume the fossilized corpses of ancient animals in the form of coal, gas, and oil, and we light them on fire to run our economy. It's brutal. It's primitive. It's killing the planet. It's killing ourselves. And those deaths add up. That's more people than die of wars, of malaria, of tuberculosis, and so on. So we have an opportunity to do heroic things here. And our ethics, it's still wrong to kill people. Our ethics can give us the energy to rise to meet this monumental challenge. Here in New York, the lion's share of our contribution to climate change, 75% of it, comes from heating our homes and transportation. So what we need are, plug-in electric vehicles. We need EV charging stations. We need a big rebate for geothermal. Happily, the governor is on the way to some of these things, but the slope of that line is not nearly steep enough. So we hope to be the wind under his wings to make even more rapid change. I think it's a two-fisted fight. On the one hand, one of our hands has to be to bar the door for more fossil fuel build-out in our state. That means no more gas storage on Seneca Lake. We cannot have any more gas-fired power plants being built. We need to close down the pipelines that feed those plants. And I'm part of that door. I'm barring the door to that. That's what I do. But the other side of it is to bring the best minds of New York together to open the door to renewable energy and do it in such a way that we're creating jobs and justice for all the communities that will be the beneficiaries. So I'm really excited to hear from that second group of people because I have been the no to fossil fuels. I'm part of that wing of the climate change movement. But the real brilliance of the engineering, the financing, the rollout, the jobs, the community benefits, they come from other people, and I'm really interested in having conversations with them.
In a moment, I'm going to ask Abby McHugh-Griffith to maybe share. She said she got a couple little stories that help illustrate what people can kind of do to help implement some of the solutions, which can, again, feel beyond reach to people. But let me ask Sandra, I'm going to follow up in one way there. When you say bar the door on future fossil fuel buildout, is that a call to all of us? Is that a call to policymakers? I mean, who are you targeting in that kind of an effort, Sandra?
Well, sure. I mean, policymakers ultimately are the ones who make this decision. I mean, as we saw with the successful attempt to stop methane, the expansion of methane storage at Seneca Lake, sometimes when policymakers don't do the right things, civil disobedience and direct action by citizenry can also help things along. And the actual tactics that we use depend on where we are in the process. But I guess I think I'll just echo what my friends in the studio are saying, that you don't have to do it all, right? That you don't have to know everything about feed-in tariffs for solar panels and know about all the toxic chemicals in fracking fluid. I mean, we can specialize in part of it. The beautiful part of this is that we're all members of this great human orchestra. We all play different instruments, but we need to find our place in the score. And the symphony we're playing is the Save the World Symphony. You know, we are decarbonizing. We're leaving fossils in the ground, just in the same way that in a previous time of our nation's history, we no longer looked to whales as the source of our energy, right? Whales are still a natural resource, but we don't light their body fat on fire anymore to run our economy. We've evolved. Now we need to leave coal, gas, and oil in the ground and look up instead of down for energy. And that requires all of us to specialize in many different things. And lastly, thanks, you guys, for serving meat. I'm a vegan myself right now, but when I was pregnant, the only source of protein I could eat were pork chops. So if we want people to be able to eat up and down in the food chain as their cultures and reproductive status dictates, I appreciate the diversity that you're offering.
All right, Abby, I know you said you got a couple of stories that might illustrate where you think solutions might be in reach or how people feel about it.
Right. So just recently, we, as the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, had a small fundraising event at Rock Brewing downtown here. And it was a climate trivia night. There were three rounds. First round focused on the problems associated with climate change. Second round focused on solutions. Third round focused on Name That Tune, actually, which was third round was tons of fun. first round, the problem focused round, people actually did much better than I would have expected. They had a very clear understanding of why we are in the situation we are in, you know, sort of how we've gotten here, who has gotten us here, et cetera, et cetera. High scores on the problem-focused round. The second round, the solutions-focused round, was mind-bogglingly poor, shall we say.
Okay.
The high score was 3 out of 10 points. And this is, you know, about 20 teams or so. 3 out of 10 points was the high score. There were 5 teams that got 0 questions right. And clearly people were feeling demoralized because they didn't understand it. People were frustrated because they couldn't answer the questions about how to solve this problem. And this actually happened after we'd already decided to have this summit, but really just reinforced the idea that what we need to be talking about and educating people about is how to solve this problem. And the second little anecdote that I would mention is that, you know, this problem of not understanding the solutions is not just, you know, in the general public. It's really climate activists and advocates as well who don't necessarily get the solutions. And I am a prime example of that. I've been leading RPCC's building efficiency team for several months now. And I'm not a renewable energy expert or building efficiency expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm sort of the one who, you know, brings this team of experts together and gets everyone talking, having conversations about how to move forward. And I only just learned, like 2 weeks ago, that air source heat pumps are a viable and affordable option as a replacement for traditional, you know, natural gas burning furnaces in our area. And this, I mean, that might not sound exciting to the general public, but that's exciting because, you know, here in the Rochester area specifically, about half of our greenhouse gas emissions come from burning natural gas for heating our homes. That's a lot. So if we want to, for example, meet the greenhouse gas emission reductions target set by the city's climate action plan, we need to stop heating our homes with natural gas and switch to all electric. And that means, you know, probably air source heat pumps or ground source heat pumps, in other words, geothermal. Mm-hmm. And geothermal, you know, I know for many people feels sort of out of reach in terms of affordability. And Sandra mentioned, you know, that it would be great if at the state level there were more incentives offered for that. But air source heat pumps, as of right now, if you are planning on replacing your furnace and or air conditioning system, just go for the air source heat pump, right? You can leave the furnace behind today. And the problem is people don't know that. I didn't know this. And I'm the one leading the team? Like, that's pretty messed up. So I'm now educated on that one small point of, you know, moving solutions forward. But I definitely recognize that there are so many other aspects of implementing solutions that I don't yet understand. And if I'm going to, you know, help educate other people about that, I need to start by educating myself.
Okay. And Neely, before I turn back to Sandra, I just want to ask you if you sense on Saturday that same frustration, maybe some of the people who are coming to the summit on Saturday feel that kind of overwhelming, I don't know about this, I don't know what I can do. What's your feeling when we feel like day to day, my individual choices either don't matter or can't make a dent?
I think that's a really good question, and we're framing the day as an opportunity to learn. And I think that shifting the tone and the tone of the conversations from none of us know everything. We have to learn all that we can. And there are, I guess, the speakers and the presenters at this summit are absolutely top-notch in sharing the information. And we are being very intentional in terms of next steps, because that's what's so important. And what one thing we really want to convey on Saturday is that this is a first step, and there will be ways for people to continue that work. There will be groups to plug into. There will be actions they can take based on what they learn. And so I guess just making sure people understand that it doesn't start and end on Saturday. It continues.
All right. Sandra Steingraber, who is with us for another couple of minutes, she's a distinguished scholar in residence in the Department of Environmental Studies at Ithaca College. One of the things you mentioned was the ongoing efforts in the Finger Lakes, particularly on the south side of Seneca Lake, dealing with proposals for gas storage and more. Can you update the audience, Sandra, on where things stand there and your thoughts on what's happening there?
Sure, I can. So there, this Houston-based energy company, Crestwood, which bought up 5 miles of prime lakefront property on Seneca Lake with an eye toward turning it into a gas station for the products of frack gas by storing them under the lake in these crumbling old salt caverns left over from salt mining. There are three gases that they propose to store there. Methane, which is natural gas. We stopped that expansion. Butane, which is cigarette lighter fluid, with a lot of citizen pressure, especially from winemakers and local businesses, the company blinked and announced it would not be sending butane into the cavern. So what remains now is one gas, propane, that the proposal is still floating around out there. The decision maker is Governor Cuomo's DEC. Basil Sagos is the commissioner. And I'm hopeful that they will the governor's office will do the right thing. The governor wishes to wear the mantle of climate leader. We want him to do that. We want him to be that leader. And that would require saying no to that last gas being stored underneath there. And so I'm sure that I know that there are lots of Seneca Lake defenders who are going to be at the summit to share their stories. I also know there will be faith leaders, business leaders, and representatives from one of my favorite groups, Elected Officials to Protect New York, which has given us such a big hand, not only on gas storage at Seneca Lake, but on the effort to decarbonize and to get fossil fuel money out of people's pensions. So right now, Elected Officials Against New York are working hard targeting Mr. DiNapoli, our comptroller, to divest the New York's common retirement from investments in fossil fuel. So I guess my message is to let people know that you can both show up at this summit knowing very little and wanting to make personal change. Like, I actually would like to work on my furnace. I'm glad to know about the air pumps. So I'll have an eye open to that. But we all are also citizens, and we can act in the political world. So bringing along your elected officials to the summit or your political candidates so that they can use their power and leverage it in much bigger ways than we can do as individuals is just as important.
All right, one more quick question for Sandra and all of the panel, because we're starting to see phone calls and comments come in. And listeners, you can call the program at 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We're talking about the upcoming Climate Summit, and it's nyclimatesummit.org to register. You can register $20 tickets. It's this Saturday at the Harley School from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. And writing to the program, a listener wants to know, are there environmental groups that support antinatalism, as in moral refuser to bear a child? And the emailer says, this is not eugenics, wants to know, I mean, it's a population question. Sandra, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think that women's fertility is not the source of our problem. I don't even think cows and goats and sheep are the source of our problems. The biggest problem we have is digging up coal, oil, and natural gas, the unholy trinity of fossil fuels, and shoving them into furnaces and lighting them on fire. That is the biggest problem, and that's what we need to stay laser-focused on.
I think Neely Kelly from Mothers Out Front is not an antinatalist. Correct?
Right.
Okay.
You
agree with Sandra on that one.
Yeah, I think, the thing that people can do to reduce carbon footprint the greatest is not have children. That's a fact. And it is not anyone's place to dictate reproductive choices. Mothers Out Front won't do that. And I think, honestly, any group that tries to control that choice for women be quiet. I mean, it's just, I have children, many of us have children, and we cannot just be wagging our finger at one another.
Sandra, thanks for taking the time, by the way. We will see you on Saturday in Rochester.
See you there, Evan.
Sandra Steingraber, distinguished scholar in residence at the Department of Environmental Studies at Ithaca College, and she's giving a closing keynote at this weekend's coming Rochester People's Climate Coalition Climate Summit. That's 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Harley School. You can still register right now at nyclimatesummit.org. One more quick comment from a listener before we get to our second half hour and bring in another guest. But Tim in Pittsford writes to say, air source heat pumps only work above freezing. He says that's why not everyone has these. Below 32 degrees, they will not be able to pull any heat from the air, and they're very expensive except in Fairport and Spencerport due to their municipal electric rates. He says, I'm not bragging, but yes, I'm an expert in these. That's from Tim in Pittsburgh.
Okay, well, so from what I understand, and I am still learning about this, certainly, one is that the technology is really coming along very quickly in terms of how it's developing. And a lot of these machines have a heating unit, a separate heating unit, where, yes, when the temperatures get too low so that you can't draw the heat out of the ambient air, that then that kicks in. And in terms of, you know, electricity rates and what that means for running an all-electric system in your house, you know, I looking down the road, it is my personal hope, and I feel fairly confident, that we will see fossil fuel prices rising. For one thing, they're already having trouble finding more of it, right? They're having to go to rather extreme lengths to dig it out of the ground, whereas wind and solar are free, renewable. They're unlimited, essentially, and the prices of those technologies are going down at fantastically swift rate. So in terms of thinking long-term, you know, price of electricity, I anticipate, and again, not being an expert, there's no guarantees in life, but that the prices of fossil fuels are going to go up, heating with natural gas is going to go up, whereas heating with renewables and your electricity is going to go down. So that would be my answer to that. But I'd love to have, you know, more in-depth conversation about this. From what I understand, there are projects going on right now in Rochester where heat pumps are being installed quite successfully, not only installed now, but have been installed, running quite successfully. So I think, Tim, reach out. We'll have a more in-depth conversation about that.
Let's get our only break of the hour, and we come back and we'll continue the discussion. We'll take more of your phone calls and questions, comments about solutions, what we can do regarding climate, and what's coming up on Saturday with the Climate Summit. That's all coming up next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on the next Connections, a new model called Self-Direction is empowering people with disabilities to live more independently. We'll hear how it works, and we'll talk to a local woman who is navigating that process. Then in our second hour, it's Christmas in October. We're going to listen to a new album of holiday music recorded on George Eastman's personal pipe organ. And we'll tell you about how you can be part of an upcoming event to celebrate it. That's Friday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. One of my favorite podcasts is called Science Versus. And it's always, every week it's a different subject, but it's just weighing the science, just the evidence, on all kinds of subjects. So it's been science versus nuclear power, science versus artificial sweeteners, science versus detoxing and cleanses. That's a delicious one. You should definitely listen to that. Science versus abortion, science versus antioxidants. But they recently did science versus 100% renewable energy with the question, can we do it? 100%, not, you know, a 50% reduction by 2040 or pick any target. 100%. It was a fascinating episode. And, what I take out of that, if you want to listen to it, what I take out of that is 100% may not be scalable at the moment, but we're not as far away as you may feel if we make some choices. And they take a look at the science behind what that would take. With that in mind, I want to bring in Zach Dufresne, who's the Director of Communications and Membership for the Alliance for Clean Energy New York, who's on the line with us now. Zach, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Zach, for you, 100% clean energy, is 100%, do we get too fixated on numbers, or do you think, in our lifetime, we could be staring at that number and saying that it's within reach?
I certainly think it's within reach. Like you said, it will take time to get there. But also, you mentioned being too fixated on numbers, and I think that's a really valid point and something we're focused on right now at my organization, Alliance for Clean Energy New York. We could ask for 200% renewable energy, but the problem is we need to get projects in the ground. Sanja spoke to this too. One of the most important things we can do is stop burning these fossil fuels, stop digging them up, stop combusting them. And in order to do that, we need to replace the energy with clean technologies such as wind and solar. We need to do that on a large scale. And rooftop solar is great. Smaller wind turbines are great. But we also need some large generators out there to replace these fossil fuel generating plants. And, you know, getting these projects in the ground as soon as possible is really paramount to combating climate change, as Sandra mentioned. But right now in New York, we're running into some serious issues getting these projects built.
Why is that?
Well, setting a project in New York State is tough in the first place. You just take into account everything from birds and bats to, you know, historical and cultural preservation. And, you know, to be clear, I'm not advocating, my organization is not advocating for doing away with these regulations. You know, we think they're a really important process and necessary process for any clean energy development. But there is an increasingly well-funded and organized opposition mounting against these projects, especially in upstate New York and western New York. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of this opposition seems to be based off misinformation and some unproven science. And as some of us have seen firsthand, these opponents tend to be the loudest ones in the room. And, you know, as I mentioned, they're increasingly well-funded and really, really giving us a hard time citing these projects. And, you know, it seems like it's this large-scale thing that we need to do to replace all of these big generating facilities, but really it comes down to we're putting these in neighborhoods. We're putting these projects, you know, in your neighborhoods, in your regions, and the opponents of those projects are coming out stronger than the supporters right now. And so that's part of our hope with this summit is engaging with some local organizations such as Mothers Out Front and others that are helping to organize this conference is, you know, hopefully we can begin to change that narrative and speak to some of that misinformation out there and really help, you know, these groups with really important voices to be heard through the appropriate channels and to figure out how to fight the opposition and how to really, you know, get started. We need to start as soon as possible replacing fossil fuel.
All right, in a moment, let me take some of our listener phone calls as most of the lines are filled up. But I know that Neely Kelly from Mothers Out Front wanted to mention something that during the break you asked me a question about something called Harbeck. Tell me about this.
Thank you, Evan. So as Abby was talking about solutions and what we can do and what we need to be doing, what came to my mind is a talk that is funded by the National Science Foundation, co-sponsored by Mothers Out Front, University of Rochester Center for Energy and Environment, and Rochester Museum and Science Center hosts a talk series once a semester. And we're in the fall semester. Last week was our talk on Harbeck Incorporated, which is a local manufacturing company, in fact, a plastics manufacturing company. And the founder and president, Bob Bechtold, told the story about how he moved his company to become 100% legitimately carbon neutral and water neutral. And it was one of the most inspiring and amazing stories I have heard in a long, long time, because the steps that Bob has taken with his company made me realize, like, all the complexities of transitioning off of fossil fuels, becoming more energy efficient, using heat to provide electricity, et cetera, the details about how we do this, he did. And for those listening who may not know, Harbeck is right up on 104. It's the wind turbines. And Zach talked about well-funded organizations. And one of the things Bob said in his presentation last week was the opposition he encountered to put up his two wind turbines. And that's the sort of thing we have to start organizing to push for at the local and state levels. Federal government is another day. But I did just want to give a shout out to Harbeck, Bob Bechtold, and the extraordinary story of taking a plastics manufacturing company to 100% carbon and water neutral. And they are local. Thank you.
Abby?
And what Neely didn't mention that I would just, you know, want to make sure everyone knows is that Harbeck, the company, saved enormous amounts of money. They're making more money because they got off of fossil fuels and switched to renewables. And I'm talking like a lot of money. So I think, you know, this is another one of those examples Sandra mentioned that implementing these solutions is to our advantage on so many different fronts. One of which being the economic opportunity it presents, you know, job creation opportunities that it presents. And Harbeck really is an inspiring example of that.
Thank you so much, Abby. I just get so lost in how amazing it was that he did this. But bottom line, saved money. And the thing that I want to say is that the talk was recorded, and we are videotaped, and we are going to post that soon on the Mothers Out Front website. So it will be available.
I've got John, and Robert waiting on the phone. I'm starting with John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Oh, good afternoon. I think there are two things that everybody in the Rochester area can do to quickly save the environment. One is to ask RG&E to switch your energy supplier to the Energy Cooperative of America, which is 100% renewable. And the second is to ask your pilot to keep it below 10,000 feet, because the introduction of fuel exhaust to the driest levels of the atmosphere impacts 3 times the amount per item of any other use of oil. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
John, thank you. Thoughts on that from our guests?
I had not heard of that below 10,000 feet one before, but John, thank you for sharing it. I think this is another one of those examples of how we all need to be more informed about the solutions and sharing information about that. And at the Solutions Summit this Saturday is a great opportunity for us to be.
Zach, let me just ask you real briefly. I'm getting ready to get on a plane tomorrow morning and fly and go visit a friend. And should I be doing less of that? What do you think, Zach?
You're on
the spot, man.
No, that's fine. That's fine. It kind of feeds into some of what we've been talking about already. You can't do everything, right? And not everyone can do everything. And if you fly less, if you need to get somewhere, that means you're driving more. And there's always trade-offs for all of these decisions that we make in our daily lives. I think being aware of those decisions and the impact of those decisions is really what's important in step one. And, you know, making an overall effort to, as I said, reduce averages. It's flying less, not never flying, but flying less. Eating less meat. You know, trying to drive less or bike more. So I don't think there's a simple answer like that. But I would be interested to know if the pilot would reduce his altitude on your request.
Yeah, interesting comment there. Yeah. By the way, here's Jeffrey on Twitter saying, Harbeck is a very compelling story. Altruism is one thing, but it made money sense too, which is such an important part of this conversation. Let me keep going with our callers on the phone. And is everybody named John today? John and Parenton. We had like 4 Johns along. Go ahead, John.
Yes, good afternoon. Glad this program is on. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple of things that I think we all need to do. One is go to our local town meetings, planning boards, town boards, etc., and keep track of the local building codes. For instance, there's a proliferation of houses in our area and even large buildings which have north-facing glass windows. Pretty crazy. And we ought to realize where we are. The second thing is, particularly with respect to hot water. Heating water and air conditioning, HVAC, hot water is the second major use outside of the furnace in our energy consumption in our homes. the local building codes should all require that the plumbing include a simple gate valve, a little push-button shut-off valve on the shower, so that you, when you get in the shower, you wet down, and instead of stepping away from the shower to soap up, you just turn that, push a little button, turn that off. You'll save between 75 and 90% of the water you use in the shower. Everyone should have one. They're about $15 or less. But they also should be part of the local building codes, because people just don't bother getting that done. So I just encourage us to pay attention. Also with garbage disposal and waste disposal, we have one of the biggest landfills in the state in Parrington. It's a shame. And we're trucking with diesel fuel waste all the way from Lake Champlain, Long Island, and points west as well. And that's just crazy. We need to reduce our waste. So those are the things I think we could all do.
John, thank you. I wonder if Abby is wondering if you're a member of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition.
We invite you to join us if you're not already, or your organization that you're affiliated with, because we are an organization of organizations. But I would just, you know, want to comment on what John was saying there about policy changes and how so many of these climate solutions will be more effective, more broadly implemented if we can change the systems, right? You know, I want to commend actually RTS right now. They're starting this Reimagine RTS process to really think about what makes sense in terms of the routes, the schedules, what kind of amenities need to be offered to encourage people to use the bus more, right? We don't want people driving as much. It's not good for the climate. So how do we make the bus more user friendly? And if we don't make those changes to the system, well, people are going to keep doing what they're used to doing. But if we provide these opportunities and make it the norm, right? So what John was saying about the water saving devices, that should, I agree, be just the norm. Your contractor comes in, you don't even really need to know about that. It's just what they do, because that's what they do in every house, right? Whether it's an actual building code change or just, you know, really widespread public education campaign. But yeah, thank you, John, for that, those important comments.
If you're just joining us, we're getting ready for the climate summit that is coming up on Saturday, the Rochester People's Climate Coalition Summit. And that summit, you can learn more about it online, nyclimatesummit.org. Tickets $20, and registration can happen right now. It's from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Harley School. Back to the phones we go. Jeff in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yes, I'm rather stunned by the agenda that's being presented here. When Wells Fargo signed people up automatically for insurance on their car rentals, that was viewed quite rightly as pretty despicable. But here we're talking about having a contractor come into your home and no options will be presented to you because this climate agenda should supersede everything else. I think it's asinine. I have solar panels on my house. When I did it, the federal and state governments paid 75% of the cost. I paid 25%. Since when is it a good deal for taxpayers to pay 75% of the cost to have something done? If something makes sense, it should make sense because of the market economics, not because of somebody's agenda. And honestly, this talk is more like a revival that I hear on a religious station.
No, hold on, Jeff. All right.
Inquiry into the options and facts.
Okay, so Jeff, I just want to ask you some questions then, because I understand what you're saying, and I take the point. I want to start by asking you that if we can be close to certain, or at least have a good level of knowledge, that our decision-making as a society is going to change this planet for future generations, yours and my kids and their kids' kids and their kids' kids' kids. And eventually we may be rendering certain parts of our planet unlivable, not to mention the impact on other species. If we know we are doing that, when you say, whose right is it to come into your house and tell you, I think, is there an argument at least? Is there a discussion that we have to make a values choice as a society? And that might mean being a little less comfortable, putting a limit on the length of a shower you can take, that kind of a thing. Or do you think
no north-facing windows? Come on, this is asinine.
No, I'm not talking about Windows. I'm speaking more generally. Forget the Windows question. Should there be any limits? Should we be allowed to set certain rules of limits? I don't know if it's on the size of the house you can own, the length of the shower you can take. I'm not endorsing it. I'm asking it as a thought experiment.
Market economics makes people that opt for some of these things pay significantly higher costs for them. And what New York State's done is tried to end run around those market economics by allocating to municipal electric power corporations like Fairport the cheap hydroelectric energy of New York State that should really belong to all citizens, but instead it's allocated specially to these cities, and you get the result that people like in Fairport use electricity, which is a much higher grade of energy that ought to be reserved for uses that justify it. But instead, the people in Fairport heat their homes with it. They actually increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the air because they're using electricity to heat they're forcing the rest of us to generate our electricity, which is done with fossil fuels. And when we're using electricity, when we're using fossil fuels to generate electricity, it's only about 35% to 45% efficient. When you use natural gas to heat your house, it's 85% to 95% efficient. Those efficiencies determine how much carbon dioxide go into the air for those processes. So just because I answer your question, NMA, doesn't mean that our governments have the competence or the integrity to correctly implement the programs to take us there.
Okay, so stay there. Thanks, Jeff. Stay there. Abby McHugh-Griffel, go ahead.
You know, so Jeff, I think you identify some really important concerns about who does make these decisions and how are programs implemented. And I really hear you when you talk about, you know, that you don't want some contractor just deciding and you not having opportunity to make choices and make decisions. And I think, you know, this to some extent really gets back to what we were talking about at the very beginning with food choices, right? That there are so many different ways of implementing solutions, so many different solutions that we can pursue, and that it's going to look a little different for each person, how they, you know, move forward on their journey to protecting our climate. Because I think, you know, we all agree that we want a livable planet for our children and our children's children. I'm sure that you and I would totally be on the same page about that. And as much as I'm going to give Evan a hard time after the show about his upcoming flight, you know, I still like him. We can still be friends. So there's that, you know, this room to agree to disagree. But I also want to specifically address what you were saying about the market and letting the market solve this problem. So I would definitely argue that at this point we have a rather major market failure. And that is that the people who are burning fossil fuels, which, you know, myself included in that, are not paying the price of the impacts of that, you know, in terms of climate change. So disaster relief, I think, is a prime example. How much are taxpayers paying right now to clean up after Harvey and Irma? And wouldn't it have been easier if we had, or we still have the opportunity, to limit the hurricanes that we're going to have and put that money into investing in renewable energy, upgrading the energy efficiency of our home, you know, in terms of where the savings come. And, you know, you mentioned the solar panels on your house in particular, and thank you so much for pursuing that, because that's an important part of the solution. But in terms of who's paying for that and who subsidizes it, you know, we do heavily subsidize the fossil fuel industry at this point, and then we also have to pay to clean up their messes, essentially. So I'd prefer my taxpayer dollars to be going toward putting the solar panels on your house and everyone else's house, and then also protecting my children and children's children.
Jeff, I only got 30 seconds because we're going to run out of time, but please go ahead.
Government by its nature is coercive, and we shouldn't expand government into areas where we don't need that coercion. And we don't need that coercion to determine what kind of solar panels I put on my house. The last hurricanes that came, no expert I've heard has said those result from our use of fossil fuels. These are specious arguments that don't deserve to be on the air.
All right, Jeff, I'm just going to jump in and tell you. I don't know experts saying that the hurricane would not have happened without climate change, but every expert who has studied it, I mean literally everyone, and if you'd like, email me and I will send you a list, will tell you that the intensity is way up. That's the issue. You have a 4 and 5 category storm making landfalls. It is the intensity. Scientific American has a big piece on this right now. I'm happy to send it to you. These are actual climatologists and people who study it. And so I'm with you. We don't know if Irma or Harvey would not have happened at all. What we can say pretty confidently is their intensity is cranked. And that's not even really debatable anymore. And I'm an evidence person. I'm with you. So if you want, I'm happy. Send me an email, edaustin@wxxi.org. Happy to do it. And we'll continue the conversation there. I cannot believe how fast this hour's gone. So if you want to continue the discussion, you got to do it on Saturday. nyclimatesummit.org if you're interested. Wow. Zach, thanks for taking the time. Zach Dufresne from the Alliance for Clean Energy New York. Thank you for joining us in the second half hour, Zach.
Evan, thanks for having me.
And our thanks to Neely Kelly, New York State Senior Organizer for Mothers Out Front. Thank you, Neely.
Thank you, Evan.
Abby McHugh-Griffith from the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Thank you, Abby.
Thank you, Evan.
And Jeff, sincerely, thanks for the phone call. We've got to continue to keep challenging each other, thinking through these ideas. They're going to try to do more on Saturday. Hope we can continue future discussions on this program. Thanks to Rob and Megan. I'm Evan. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.